Hello and welcome back to Heights Library's podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. Diane Negra of the School of English, Drama, and Film at the University College of Dublin discusses her current work, Modalities of Irishness, and updates that research and particularly looks at how new Irish-themed necropolitical imagery, meaning skulls, skeletons, etc., has proliferated in the era of Black Lives Matter and Defund the Police. This is our conversation from October 17th, 2022.
My name is Diane Negra, and I am Professor of Film Studies and Screen Culture at University College Dublin.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. And today we'll be talking about Irishness in the American experience, correct?
Yeah, I think we had said that we would maybe try to walk our way very roughly through a history of Irishness in American popular culture, which is one of my research fields, and with a particular attentiveness to race, and maybe as we go along to this morning to try to unpack a little bit the complex ways in which Irishness in American popular culture is a race category, some of the things that have changed over time. And what I may do, if that's okay with you, John, is just simply start with the early 60s, which I think is a kind of a key period. I think most will be aware that this is also the period in which John F. Kennedy is elected to the White House. And it is a period in which Irishness seems to undergo a fairly pronounced status change in American life. So I would be inclined to kick off with that, because I think it's in that moment of the early 1960s that Irishness, which had intermittently in the past been a stigmatized identity, becomes a credential. And one sign of that is the choice made in exactly this period by two American corporations to brand products that don't need to be branded Irish in that way. And I'm alluding to General Mills, the breakfast cereal company that rolls out Lucky Charms breakfast cereal, still going strong today. It has a long history of being advertised on American television, and it'll be familiar to lots of people for its ubiquity, I suppose, in American life. And I have an example of some of the early advertising that rolls out Lucky the Leprechaun in this period that viewers can see. But another comparable case is that of Colgate-Palmolive, which chooses in the early 1960s to brand a soap that they call Irish Spring. And again, although I don't think it's advertised quite as much, perhaps as Lucky Charms cereal has, for people who watched television in the 1960s, 70s, and into the 80s, this was an awfully familiar brand. And it's interesting, I think, that Colgate-Palmolive chose to, just as General Mills invented a character, Lucky Leprechaun, so too did Colgate-Palmolive. And in their case, they cast the role of Sean, a kind of Irish country man who walks around in bucolic settings, somewhat confusingly, with a bar of green soap in his pocket and a penknife, and he's always slicing the soap open to sort of show its purity. So I mentioned those two long-running and very familiar advertising campaigns because I think they have made an imprint on American popular culture. It's still common today for people to reference things like Lucky Charms cereal when they allude to Irishness in some way. But also what really strikes me is that these were products, unlike, let's say, lace or crystal or whiskey, where there isn't a kind of baked-in association to Irishness. It was constructed and invented. So I think that tells us something about a change that's playing out in this period, the 1960s, and that will go forward really from there, in which Irishness becomes something positive, something desirable, something, as I say, that's an attribute that's often taken to be positively rendered in some way. I'd skip ahead, I suppose, from that point a little bit to the late 80s and into the 1990s. And I've written a bit about this in the past. I see this period, let's call it a decade, roughly speaking, right up until the millennium, as a period in which an explosion of Irish-themed popular culture really takes place. And some of the images that we'll have up to accompany this section will include, you know, obviously the the global popularity of U2, the incredible success of Frank McCourt's memoir, Angela's Ashes, which of course later becomes a film, the plays of Martin McDonagh on Broadway, and then more diffusely, the rise of Irish-themed merchandising, and notably by the 1990s in America, the rise of Irish shops. In other words, shops, and they're not necessarily in the places you might expect, you know, New York, Boston, Chicago, they're there, of course, but in the suburbs, right? And this kind of sense that American consumers are being invited to participate in an Irish-themed economy in which they can purchase a range of goods, some with a clear connection to Ireland, some very much not. But this kind of sense that again, Irishness surges as an identity that Americans seem to want to claim. And one sign of this also is U.S. Census data in this period, because when Americans are asked, you know, about their own ethnic origins, and many of us don't know, it must be said, right? This is always a kind of a selective and imperfect process. Americans overclaim Irishness. So the desirability of Irishness, the sense that it is something that carries with it a history, a meaningfulness, a kind of, I write about Irishness as a consoling ethnic category that maybe as the United States moves to the end of the 20th century, and there's a kind of a building existential uncertainty about America's place in the world, about, you know, America's moral status, you know, these kinds of things, that the pleasure of feeling that you can be Irish, you know, which is, you know, this kind of sense, Irishness, I think, more than any other ethnic category in American life is very much, you know, one that can be elected. And so the sense that Irishness is a form of whiteness, surely, but a kind of a safely ethnic tinged form of whiteness that through which one can sort of mitigate an Americanness that maybe becomes a little bit burdensome, ideologically speaking, in this period. And so through popular culture images, you know, I would see that happening in the way that people flock to Irish-themed popular culture products, whether they're films or plays or, you know, boxes of cereal, you know, you sort of take your pick, or memoirs or you know, the explosion in this period, for example, of, you know, products, and I will call them products, you know, from Ireland itself. So one of the things that's happening, of course, in the 1990s is rampant globalization. And that makes the traffic of Irish-themed goods, including people, right, celebrities very much fit in here, you know, easier. And the kind of sense that Americans are feeling their Irishness in this decade, to me, is very, very apparent. And so we have this kind of extended period in which a romance is going on, a cultural romance between America and Ireland. Ireland in this period is going through a phase of extraordinary economic success that would later, well, really was even in the period known as the Celtic Tiger. So Ireland is taking up a new position on the world stage. It has some very distinguished leaders during this period. Mary Robinson is one of them. And there is a sense that Ireland itself is leaving behind some fairly difficult history and taking up this kind of new position in world affairs. And so there is this kind of sense that America is looking to Ireland through tourism, through commodity acquisition and practices of genealogy, for example, but also that Ireland is looking to the U.S. In a particular way, looking to cement a bond that is, you know, that academic think of as diasporic, because of course so many Irish people at various times did emigrate to the United States, and this romance that I'm talking about is partly romance between the descendants of those people and the homeland that they feel connected to, but also with people who have no manifest connection to Ireland, but simply like the idea of Ireland, however that is construed. And often that's grounded in the images of particular popular culture figures, as I've said, whether authors or musicians or politicians, perhaps in some cases, Americans start to take a much bigger interest in this period in what's going on in the North, for example, politically and things like this. So it's a very interesting period, I think, to go back to. And I want to kind of just for the moment hold the question of what makes Irishness so attractive to so many Americans and how it operates as what I would think of as a kind of a fantasy in many ways, a fantasy that, as I've suggested, is consoling on many levels. And I would think that that period is partly about the psychology of U.S. white middle class identity and the role that Irishness can play in negotiating that. I've just started, I think, to suggest some of the ways that that's the case. But what I think is rather interesting in this, if we insert illustrations into this talk, as I know we will, the illustrations that people will see at this point are rather different. So instead of, you know, the cover of Frank McCourt's book or an image of Riverdance, which was a global sensation in the 1990s, of course, or the images of various Irish themed products, you know, shamrock bedecked merchandise and this sort of thing. And around the turn of the century, around as we head from the 1990s into the noughties, my sense is that in broad terms, images of Irishness start to shade darker, and that we get a cluster, for example, of Irish crime fiction. And I'm using the term Irish to encompass Irish American, of course. I've put up an image there of The Departed, right? A very successful film in roughly this period about Irish gangsterism in Boston. And it's in the same period that we have the rise of the Irish American commentator on the right, particularly this is roughly the period in which Fox News kind of lands in American broadcasting, and so many of the Fox hosts implicitly or in many cases explicitly identify themselves as Irish Americans. So one important archetype of Irishness in the early 2000s is the image of the right-wing man, you know, on Fox News, or, you know, or a criminal figure, or, you know, these sometimes played by Irish actors, for example, like Colin Farrell, sometimes not, but this kind of sense that Irishness has entered a new mode and that it's certainly sustaining an affiliation to Americanness, which I think is really important. But I think the thing that's starting to happen here most significantly is that at its most extreme, Irishness is becoming a sanitizing element in expressions of white race pride. And this is a period in which American life has shifted, right? If we talk about, let's say, the last 20 years, roughly speaking, and an emerging new level of consciousness about, you know, everything from the sort of sense of Black Lives Matter, but the shifts, for example, and the rather well-known fact that, in fact, you know, white Americans will be emerging as a racial minority in the United States in due course. And possibly more significantly than those things, a set of economic developments which puts enormous downward pressure on the middle class, and particularly, arguably, I think, takes a toll on a middle class that sees itself as descended from the Irish, or, you know, for whatever reason, has a kind of a psychological affinity with Irishness. So I think that we start to see Irishness being particularly worn here as a form of ideological and racial armor, if I can put it like that. And so that there's a kind of sense that Irishness is a stake. In other words, it connects you to a history of colonialism. It connects you to diaspora and the horrific conditions of famine under which, you know, many people did emigrate from Ireland, particularly in the 1800s and later too. But this sense that the upbeat celebratory Irishness of the 1990s is giving way to darker shadings, as I say, in crime narratives, in tribalistic, bleak renderings. Television really moves toward Ireland, toward Irishness, rather, in series like The Black Donnellys, for example. And this pushes things in a very interesting direction, it seems to me, because Irishness becomes available as a way of speaking a precariously classed, uncertain form of American whiteness. It becomes, you know, as I say, on one extreme, a way of articulating race pride that maybe would otherwise be taboo. And so my sense is that as we push ahead more, you know, more closely to the contemporary moment, that this kind of sense sense of Irishness as a as an identity credential among, let's say, Fox News commentators, among those close to Donald Trump and his administration, many of whom were emphatically Irish American, that Irishness is being mobilized in a way that we should be attentive to and conscious of, and that it's increasingly also being tapped to somehow activate a sense of the past or a sense of heritage that can help us reconcile with the present. And that would move me to some much more recent images, but images that I think are awfully important, some of which you can see, you know, very regularly on t-shirts or baseball caps or bumper stickers. And these images are really striking to me. I would call them necropolitical because they incorporate some of the traditional images of Irishness, the ones that I identified as upbeat shamrocks, little hats, you know, jaunty figures. But these figures are also marked out as death figures. They're skeletons or skull heads, sometimes with an Irish tricolor over them. And the sense that I have from these images is that they are prepared to even intensify that darker imagery that starts to emerge maybe about 20 years ago. And the sense that some of these images are accompanied by little slogans, Irish to the bone is one, which is meant to be obviously a play on skeletal imagery. But what does it mean that Irishness in a U.S. context is now being correlated with death in this way? And again, my sense is that there's a kind of a sequential process here, that Irishness, as I've written about it, particularly around 9/11 and the sense of loss of firefighters and police and others in 9/11, becomes a kind of a rejoinder to Islamic terrorism, that Americanness is kind of enhanced by an association with an Irish innocence, as I've written about it. But then as time goes on, and a number of factors destabilize the white middle class in this country, and I probably don't need to rehash it. Many have spoken to this, but all the ways in which, you know, downward mobility, uncertainty, and contraction are the watchwords of middle class identity in this country now. So the fact that we start to see these images of a necropolitical Irishness, a deathly Irishness, which is conscious of history but is also aware, at some level, I think of a kind of surplus future particularly for white working class and middle class men. I think that's one of the anxieties being staged here. And I have seen these kinds of images of skulls with Irish tricolors layered over them on bumper stickers with on vehicles that also have, for example, the Police Benevolent Association sticker, or other, you know, various kinds of signs of remembrance of 9/11 and first responders. So it seems to me that, especially in the what I think is the tri-state area around New York, that there is a kind of tribal Irishness that's being called upon through these images to say a couple of things, to say we have a heritage too, in a kind of a cultural environment in which Black and Latino heritage has acquired new visibility and new value. But the assertion of whiteness is marked out as problematic and uncertain and associated with privilege. I think Irishness helps get around that problem of white privilege. That's how it's being, you know, called upon anyway, as this very useful, you know, kind of narrative element in the story of people who don't see themselves as oppressors, don't see themselves, you know, as you know, they see themselves as having urgent concerns in 21st century America, not people of automatic privilege or status. And they call upon images of Irishness and have done for a while to assert that value. But also now with the turn towards skeletal and death imagery, which by the way, is something that in the north of Ireland, loyalist representations had gone through a phase like this as well, in which in murals and other sites, they would frequently use the images of the marauding skeletal kind of warrior at times. So it seems to me that when a subculture turns to this kind of imagery to represent itself, it is worried about its obsolescence. It is worried about its own kind of imminent death. And this is what I would argue we're finding now in this kind of new necropolitical set of images around Irishness in America. I'm not arguing that they circulate broadly and nationally, but they've really kind of piqued my interest, particularly in New York, which is where I've seen them the most in recent years, on T-shirts and other kinds of, you know, signs of identity that people, you know, kind of wear, and the sense that Irishness has moved. If we go back to the 1960s, and it's kind of upbeat, hopeful, aspirational register, right, and the sense that Irishness can be something everybody can claim, right? We see this on Patrick's Day, right? Every March, you know, and the kind of idea that Paddy's Day is a holiday in which everyone gets to be Irish. Well, that idea of Irishness as accessible, the idea also of Irishness as your default identity, if you don't know your own ethnic history, or if, like so many Americans, you are multi-ethnic or multiracial, that you might have elected to say, well, I'm Irish, right? And it's very common, and nobody really bats an eye if someone American says, I'm Irish. And what they mean by that is that, you know, their grandmother left Cork in 1848, right? It's not really the way that Americans talk about other ethnic categories. So on the one hand, there's the sense that Irishness is open to everybody. But on the other hand, as I'm speaking to in these remarks, I think over the last 60 years, we can see it moving from something that spoke hopefully and optimistically to something that increasingly speaks of an anxiety, a precarity, and an uncertainty that the United States is working for the kinds of people who seem to want to affiliate with Irishness as a category. And this is how I would interpret the rise of Irish to the bone skeletons and, you know, images of sort of marauding Celtic warrior figures and things like this, which we see popping up, is to express a kind of a reverse of that hopefulness and that optimism that was there 60 years ago. Instead, a kind of a dread and a sense that one's last recourse is to at least express an understanding that you are being made obsolete, that you're being pushed out of the cultural frame. So there's a lot of kind of racialized resentment here. There's a lot of uncertainty here about the kind of rules of American life, if we can put it that way, and a kind of sense that Irishness, which has long operated as a proxy discourse for Americanness, is still doing that. But what it's saying, I think, is something very despairing about the terms, conditions, and possibilities of American life right now. I'm obviously generalizing, and, you know, since my field is popular culture, I'm making these assessments, you know, based on things like film and celebrity and television and popular music and, you know, T-shirts and things like that. So I want to emphasize that I'm being suggestive here more than I am being definitive. And it should also be clear that I'm describing states of feeling that are unconscious for the most part. And I'm not, but in any way, suggesting that someone who puts on a kind of an image of a skeleton that says Irish to the bone on it is doing so, you know, fully aware of what signal they're sending. And they might have some awareness, or they simply might not. But I think that is how popular culture often works in terms of its pleasures and gratifications, is that it's not a conscious state, right? It's, oh, I like that. Oh, that's interesting to me. Oh, that gives me pleasure. But we tend not to be a society that diagnoses or pinpoints those pleasures. But that's the broad arc that I think we should be thinking about when we think about how Irishness has operated in the United States as a kind of state of racialized identity over the last 60 years, that it's moved through some remarkable peaks. And one of those peaks I've suggested is the 1990s, in which global popular culture delivers a succession of Irish-themed cultural products, including rock bands and plays and books and, you know, you name it, basically, in that period. And then maybe it slightly abates, but it's found a new register in the last 20 years, in the 21st century, in being a kind of a sign of conservative feeling in many instances, and particularly a kind of a riposte, a pushback of white Americans who are defensive about their racial status and who are in effect saying, we have a stake here too. And I think that is something that politically we want to untangle, and we want to be, if I can put it like this, We want to be hearing the signals that people may be sending through this kind of messaging around Irishness and what it is that they are concerned about and how they think about their own identities. And so my sense is that when we talk about Irishness in 21st century America, we're often talking about a nervous whiteness, a whiteness that is desirous of protecting its territory, of defending its sense of itself. It's strongly associated with certain professions, particularly in areas like New York, with policing, most notably, and things like this. But I would say it's also become, if anything, more of a masculine discourse in some ways. And that, too, I think bears noticing and bears some analysis. But that would be my very short history of how Irishness in the last 60 years or so has kind of exploded in American life as a category of representation in various ways, and as a kind of popular culture keynote, and as something that, if we take it seriously and examine it, can offer us insights into kind of aspects of American racial thought.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I think the main question I have, and I kind of want to return to this idea of kind of the shift from U2 to this kind of almost a Blue Lives Matter kind
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
And I think like U2 very much situated themselves in a civil rights, human rights kind of push, like coming out of Ireland, we've been oppressed. We're going to sing, we're going to tie ourselves to Martin Luther King, and we're going to kind of sing about these heavy social issues.
Yeah.
And we kind of have moved into, as you were saying, the Fox News kind of conservative, white male, police professional celebration. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could, I mean, outside of the economic aspect of it, can you maybe unpack a little bit more about the racial and why it may become attractive for people who have bad, like white supremacists would use the Irish iconography mm-hmm. to radicalize. And that kind of like, and we're seeing it like we spoke about earlier with the Viking and the like the pagan and the Nordic kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's not necessarily white supremacy, but it becomes a gateway into it.
It's awfully close in some instances. Yeah, well, I appreciate that, John. I think you're right that a lot of the kind of 90s discourse on Irishness had a social justice flavor, not least you two who are going to be undertaking in 2023 a long-term Las Vegas residency. Bono has a book out. Yeah, it's a memoir. He's been around a fair bit lately. He won a prize, the Fulbright Prize for International Understanding in, I want to say, March, and made a speech. I was present at that speech in which, you know, he talked in the terms he has long talked, you know, about the need for social justice and understanding. So there is a gap, isn't there, between that version of Irishness in the 1990s, which was partly about, you know, I said it was that Irishness is a consoling category, but the re-cementing between Ireland and America of a kind of bond in that period was also very gratifying for Ireland. And the kind of sense that you know, high-profile Irish figures, whether you're talking about somebody like Bono, you're talking about somebody like Mary Robinson, or, you know, the current president, Michael D. Higgins, who also, you know, regularly speaks to social justice issues. One of the things I would say about the current moment is that there is an interesting gap opening up. In other words, for a long time, I think Americans were invited to come back to Ireland to feel grounded, to feel that they had a homeland that was accessible to them. But increasingly, as the U.S. has moved in a more rightward political direction, if they make those kind of homeland visits, they are encountering a country that reads as more politically progressive than the United States, you know, with recent referenda in favor of equal marriage and things of that sort. Ireland increasingly looks like the progressive outlier. And when, you know, in recent years, it's been fairly common for Americans to fantasize retirement overseas or, you know, expatriation. Or, you know, you have people like Alec Baldwin who said, well, if Trump gets elected, I'm moving to Ireland. He didn't, but he said he would. But this kind of sense that Ireland is kind of always there, but on what terms? And so I think one of the things that's very interesting is that one could make the case that, you know, contemporary Ireland, which is very, very eager, especially at the moment, to reach out to what is being called the affinity diaspora, and particularly to understand the entangled histories of Blackness and Irishness globally, but in the United States most particularly, that, you know, the kind of Irishness that's invoked in t-shirts of skeletons and tricolors is of a very different order. And so you have a kind of it's a very mixed field, I think we can reasonably say. And on the one hand, you have this kind of invocation of Irish heritage and a kind of primordial Irishness. As you said, you know, the January 6th, you know, insurrection event in the U.S. Capitol, you know, was interesting for partly because it reads as a kind of a cosplay of Viking accoutrements, and the way in which people dress themselves, costume themselves for that occasion runs really close to, it seems to me, to this kind of activation of Irish-themed marauders and skeletal, and, you know, these are images of sort of a masculinity that doesn't have to be answerable, that is deeply angry, that understands its disenfranchisement, right, and that asserts its right to be disenfranchised even though it is white, you know, that kind of thing. It seems really important, you know, but meanwhile you have an Ireland which is increasingly out of alignment with that older image. So the former idea of the American tourist was that you could go back to Ireland and find the place that had never changed, right? And you know, it's typical of Americans to think that the Irish are more pious than they are, more church-going, more traditional, etc. You know, but that kind of construction of Ireland as the place where you could get the past back was widely promulgated. And now you have a kind of an interesting dissonance, because if that's the reason why you seek out Ireland, for example, as a tourist or visitor in some capacity, you are going to find, I think, that isn't really available for the most part, you know, and so I think what we might also say about 21st century Irishness is that it is increasingly operating on a couple of different tracks, and that those tracks are very, very separate and possibly collide with one another at times. But I think what's being invoked in these images of white fierceness, white rage, white justification, you alluded to Blue Lives Matter, right? And the sense that, you know, these images of angry Irish-themed masculinity have emerged roughly in the period of the pandemic and hopefully after, in which, you know, police, for instance, have felt very, very hard done by. They have felt very criticized. It's been alleged that some police are essentially doing very little work or quiet quitting or, you know, whatever, that they feel that they are not being socially valued. So why should they play the part of the protector? So this kind of repertoire, these images of angry Irishness come along also as a mode of expression at a time when we seem to be going through some very difficult debates in America about what policing should consist of, in a period after which, you know, after George Floyd and so many cases, both historical and ongoing, in which police officers brutally assaulted Black Americans. And so all of this is charged in a kind of racial arena. And I think what I'm trying to speak to is the way in which Irishness gets called upon by people who feel maybe a degree of discomfort by calling on whiteness, but the way in which they summon Irishness is a way of doing that in code.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point. So is there anything else you'd like to leave us with as we wrap this up here?
I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things I would say as somebody, you know, as a cultural studies scholar and somebody who thinks about, you know, what popular imagery and popular narratives can tell us, I would say we're in a fairly tough spot in this country. And the thing that's very much needed is more forms of dialogue, you know, for example, between police and the populations that they encounter and that sort of thing. And that this kind of self-justifying, defensive and bellicose imagery is not serving that purpose. So I would hope that, you know, you had mentioned a few moments ago the kind of the long history of Irishness also being invoked in social justice context, and, you know, in context of trying to have, you know, my sense is that if we could better consider how downwardly mobile white Americans can make common cause with Black and Latino Americans, that would be a far better goal than defending white privilege in whatever fashion. So I would be rather critical and mistrustful of this new turn in Irish American self-representation. And I think what it's telling us is there's something at the heart of it, which is an expression of vulnerability. I know it would seem the opposite in these images of skulls and what have you, but I think they are being used partly to express fear and a fear that's the kind of perceived social value of various groups in America is under revision. I think if we could have a conversation about that openly, that would serve us far better than these images of what I'm reading as kind of Irish themed race pride.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to.